we present the news quiz with your host, Miles Jupp.
Hello and welcome to the news quiz. We start with a cutting from The Guardian, read by Zeb Soans.
The government-appointed body reviewing the Freedom of Information Act has held its first official briefing. Our aim is to be as open as possible, said an anonymous source.
And our thanks to Henk van Claveren for sending us that piece of impishness. Now, let's meet the teams. Will you welcome first on my right, Jeremy Hardy and Holly Walsh. And opposite them on my left, comedian and actor Yasmin Akram and Telegraph political sketchwriter Michael Deacon. Jeremy, which minister's plans are under attacks from his own backbenchers?
Well, George Osborne, ably assisted by IDS, the Workhouses and Pensions Secretary, have decided to grind the noses of the poor into the dirt. And there has been rebellion from some Tory backbenchers, and also in the House of Lords, there is a threat of a fatal motion. Admittedly, any physical activity can be fatal, members of the House of Lords. But the House of Lords is now to the left of the Tory party. It comes to something when people who can barely keep track of their own saliva have more awareness of what life is like for ordinary people than elected ministers. But people say, well, it's not really Cameron's fault and Osborne's fault because, you know, they're born into privilege and they don't understand. They're just disconnected. They have no... I don't think that's the problem. I think they do understand. I think they don't care. It can't be that hard to figure it out. All you've got to do is think about all the stuff you've got and imagine your life without any of that stuff. It can't be that hard for well-educated, intelligent people. So clearly, they just quite like the idea. If people haven't got the get-up-and-go to be born into money and have an offshore trust fund, then you have to incentivise them by removing food from their house. Because they keep saying, well, people got to work their way out of poverty. And you say, yeah, but these people are working. That's the point. Well, we'll make sure they get the living wage. And, yeah, but a lot of them are self-employed and they can't really pay themselves more. You know, if you're self-employed, you can't go on strike against yourself and not sue yourself for unfair dismissal or anything like that. You're kind of in a bit of a corner, you know. So it's a most extraordinarily brutal period in our history.
But not something that's gone down well with all...
No, there's a couple of Tories who said, don't do that, that's beastly to the poor, and we're supposed to like them in a patrician, old-fashioned, one-nation way. They're supposed to be grateful to see us and doff their caps to us in the street. The great union between the upper and lower classes. And Nigel Lawson, who occasionally pops up to deny climate change or show how he can shrink and enlarge over a period of time... He said it could be tweaked, because they keep saying, well, look, the thing is, you see, it could be compensated, but everybody in Institute of Fiscal Studies says, no, it's not. The poorest people are going to be poorer. There's no way around it. But it might be that there is a vote fast, because there is division in the Tory ranks, and they might do a U-turn.
The thing I don't understand is that they did a vote about it, and none of the Tories voted against it anyway. So they made a stand, and they sort of stood up and said, we shouldn't be doing this. But none of them voted against it. Is that right?
Well, it was an opposition day debate, which basically means the vote is non-binding, so it didn't mean anything. It was just for the sake of having a debate.
It's a bit like the general election, really, because they said they weren't going to do it, and now they have.
I am from a very working-class background. My mother, she was a single parent. We were raised in a council estate in Ireland, and even though we did need help, I don't think anyone should have given her any help because my mother was a terrible human being. And so in some ways, I can see why they just throw it out there. Like, you know, like, let's just maybe stop helping people. Because I know my mother, when she was a child, her big dream was to grow up and have two children on her own and not be able to find new work. That was what she really worked towards. And at the age of 31...
It's aspirational, isn't it?
It's really aspirational. I don't think that, you know... So I think, I wouldn't be here if we didn't have some help of some kind in educating myself and my sisters and giving some money to us. So, yeah, I don't really understand.
There is a rationale behind this. George Osborne has been explaining it this week.
He hasn't explained it to me, though, because I still don't understand.
I'm from Telegraph, therefore I'm his mouthpiece.
Okay.
He's explained it. He says that he has to cut tax credits for low-paid people because if he doesn't, there'll be an economic crisis. And if there's an economic crisis, the people who get hurt worst of all are the low-paid, and they're therefore... by reducing the income of the low-paid, he's making them better off. It's as simple as that. I don't know why you don't seem to be following that. It's very straightforward. Joe's fault this is really. It's Jeremy Corbyn's fault. I know everything is Jeremy Corbyn's fault, but this kind of is, in a way, because the election of Jeremy Corbyn has made the Tories like Osborne think, oh, we're invincible, we can do anything, because that guy is so unelectable, we can do what we like. Now, they may be wrong about that, they may be wrong, I mean, but in a way, that's not the point. The fact is, they believe that, and therefore, even though they're coming under some pressure at the moment for cutting tax credits for low-paid people, they think, oh, well, we'll just do it anyway, because ultimately, what's going to happen to us? Whereas if Labour had found some candidate that was at least, I don't know, more conventional, that the Tories might be more nervous about. If they came under pressure, they might think, well, maybe we should do a U-turn on this, maybe water it down a bit. But I think Osborne's just thinking, well, the hell, I'm going to be Prime Minister anyway. It doesn't matter what anyone says.
Yeah. So,
I think you vastly underestimate the sheer cruelty of the Tory front bench.
Like all these stories, it'll either be a terrible disaster or a roaring success, and who are we to judge in advance, I suppose? Did you see Heidi Allen?
Oh, yeah, she's the one who used her maiden speech to stand up and berate the big guys, which was quite impressive of her, I thought. I liked it.
Yeah, I thought that was a terrific speech. And there are quite a lot of backbench Tory MPs who are against this. You know, a lot of them in marginal seats who think, well, I've got a lot of constituents, so this is going to hurt. And they actually don't think it's right. Boris Johnson also says he doesn't think it's right, although at the moment Boris Johnson, for some reason, is always saying the opposite opinion of anything that George Osborne says. I don't know why that is. I don't know what his thinking is behind this. I don't know what he's planning in about 2 years' time.
I think Osborne's problem is that he was raised in London. He's not a county Tory. So he was raised in London, which meant he would have got on buses with poor people who would probably have teased him because he went to the sort of school where your uniform is some sort of Elizabethan beekeeping costume. So kids in polyester blazers and sweatshirts sneered at him, whereas, you know, Cameron's experience of the poor is more that they're the sort of people who get peppered with shot while they're trying to drive grouse out of bracken for you. And then you buy their family a cottage to apologise for their death.
Vexingly, this is a potential rebellion against the plans to cut tax credits as proposed by Chancellor of the Exchequer and adolescent haircutted butler to Satan, George Osborne. Dissent amongst Conservative MPs is reportedly growing to the point where some of them are seriously considering writing some sort of letter, stiff or otherwise. Conservative MP Heidi Allen used her maiden speech to attack the plans in the most reckless maiden outing since the HMS Titanic set off with more violinists than lifeboats. Allen's speech was warmly received by Osborne, who congratulated her with a touching and generous throat-slitting gesture. Meanwhile, the rebellion in the House of Lords very nearly led to the passing of what they describe as a fatal motion, which I'm fairly sure is what happened to Elvis. Of course, wanting to make work pay is a noble goal, and to do so, it's important that the financial safety net provided by tax credits is removed first, just as you would remove an actual safety net before training someone to balance on a tightrope high above some hard, unforgiving concrete. Before the last election, the Conservatives boldly claimed to be the party of working people, but unfortunately forgot to include the postscript, into an early grave. 2 points to Jeremy. Holly, have a listen to this.
She may be the face I can't forget, a trace of pleasure or regret, maybe my treasure or the price I have to pay.
Holly, which she is the she we won't forget?
This is President Xi, President Xi Jinping, the Chinese president, who has been on a state visit this week. I mean, everybody's gone mad for him, haven't they? They did everything. They did a 41-gun salute in Green Park, and he had a state banquet and a trip to Chequers and then a day out in Manchester. It was like, it's like a sort of dirty weekend in England. It was amazing. And so thrilled to have him. I mean, there was an element of supreme bum-kissing that went on in the last few days, but one of my favourite things I read about it was that when he met the Queen, they have that sort of customary thing where they give presents to one another, state presents, and the Queen, because he was a big fan of Shakespeare, gave him a collection of Shakespeare's sonnets, and President Xi gave the Queen two of his wife's folk albums. The Queen must have been a bit disappointed. She was like, well, if we were giving each other merchandise, I would have just given you some stamps. I just love the idea that that's what, you know, that they were like, oh, forgot to get the Queen a present. What have we got? And she's got, I'll just sign a couple of albums, give them to her. Or the idea that that happens the other way around, that the Cameron turns up in China and is like, thank you so much for the panda. And in return, I'd like to give you this CD, which has Samantha having a stab at Greensleeves.
Because the thing is, I mean, like, Jeremy Corbyn agreed to meet him and he agreed to criticise him privately. And because people said, you can't, don't be rude, don't say anything to him. And Corbyn has had all this grief about people that he's met in the past, but somehow this guy is our guy and we've got to be nice to him. And people said, look, there's no good grandstanding and offending somebody by attacking his human rights record. The best way for us to put pressure on this man is to give him control of our nuclear power stations.
Has anyone been to Hinkley Point, where the nuclear power station's going to be?
No, not
right, really. Gotcha. I have.
I hope when they laid out, when they had the big posh banquet at Buckingham Palace, they, instead of getting out the silver, they got stainless steel out. Just to make the point.
Well, yeah, how does this actually... Does this all relate to the British industry that's...
They dump very low-priced steel in our economy and that's knackered our steel industry.
Yeah, they've shut down... Well, this week they announced that they were going to... I think they were going to make 1,500 or something steelworkers redundant. And if I've learned anything from British films, that means a huge rise in male strippers.
And some protest. Did anyone see the protests?
Yeah, they drowned it out. The Chinese embassy went out giving T-shirts and tanks out to supporters supporters of the regime.
If there was ever a banner that said sort of free Tibet or whatever, they'd move somebody in front of them with a huge Chinese flag to block out.
Well, they had a Chinese dragon as well, so they could be sort of versatile and use it to cover any shape of protest.
Can I just, you know, we're all knocking poor old President Xi here. Can I just say something in his favour? Because there was a press conference with him at number 10 Downing Street, and Laura Koonsberg of the BBC asked him a really awkward question about human rights. But I thought he took it really well, and in fact, you know, he's invited her to visit China to report on what life is like in a slave labour camp. And he's going to give her 40 years of access. So, you know, credit to the guy.
Well, it's a big thing in China about saving face, you see. It's a cultural thing. In the tyrant community, people don't like any sort of challenge. And people are saying this in defence of President Xi. They're saying, well, the thing is, it's a partly a cultural thing that they don't take criticism very well. Well, that is kind of what we're saying about him, really. You know, if he wasn't so thin-skinned, he wouldn't torture people for trying to form trade unions. That is what we're saying. But it's just that thing you can say, well, it's just a thing that we do, that we dictators do. Because he even said that. He said, well, we care about human rights, but China is in a different place in our history. That place is called dictatorship. And you cannot expect people in a dictatorship to be able to function as Democrats because they have no freedom.
Have you been enjoying the state visit?
Well, I saw some pictures of that online and I was quite jealous because I met the Queen a couple of years ago and she was quite cold to me. And we were in Buckingham Palace and I said
Did
to
you,
her...
Can I just ask, was it like an official thing? Were you breaking into her room?
I broke into her room a little bit. I was on like an official visit. That surprised everyone in this room. He thought, no one's going to let her near the Queen. But I got to her. And we were in Buckingham Palace and she was approaching me. So I looked at her and went, oh, this is a really lovely room, isn't it? There was a big, long pause. And then she went, yes, I've always liked it. And I was like, yeah, me and the Queen. Oh, well, like, we're next, corgis. And like, you know, there's loads of stuff to talk about. So, but she seemed quite at ease in his company. And it made me think, maybe the Queen has forgotten about meeting me. So
she might just have been intimidated by you as well. A lot of people just sort of probably stand there not knowing what to say, whereas you sort of cut through all that with your incisive remarks about what a nice room it is. How am I going to keep up with this lady?
I was just... And I had that... Oh, I even hate thinking this, but there was a moment where, very clearly in my mind, I thought, I know if she stays here any longer, I'm going to say something about Diana. I know I will. It would just come out. So I, when she moved on, it was the happiest moment of my life because I cannot stop myself. It was in my throat going, so what happened with Diana there, do you think?
So Suddenly, this is the state visit of China's President Xi Jinping to Great Britain, where he met with the Queen in order to pick up tips on how to cling to power for 63 years without ever having to bother with an election. Although it's not really fair to say President Xi is unelected, he was elected by the 373 members of the 18th Central Committee of the Communist Party of China, who, as I feel I must point out, are a great bunch of lads. President Xi was shown around the country by David Cameron in the obsequious manner of an estate agent telling a prospective buyer he could have the place furnished or unfurnished, and if he didn't like the look of Yorkshire, he could always just knock it through. As part of the visit, Cameron announced that the Chinese are building a new nuclear power station in Somerset. When finished, the reactor will produce electricity at more than double the current wholesale price and will remain at that price for 35 years. Basically, emigrate. Anyway, we're lucky to live in a society where we're allowed to make these kind of jokes. At least until the Chinese government tells Cameron otherwise. 2 points to Holly. Michael, who caused an ooh-la-la with his Carney knowledge?
That will be Mark Carney, the governor of the Bank of England, who gave a speech this week about the European Union. And depending on which newspaper you read, he either said the EU is absolutely super, it's been great for Britain, thumbs up, or he said, oh, I'm not sure about this EU thing, oh, I wonder about that, maybe we should consider a vote for out. But I feel that he overlooked a key issue in his speech, which is that the EU referendum debate is the most lethally dull subject in the universe, and not only is it screamingly tedious, but it's also at the moment pointless, because not only do we not know when this referendum is going to be, it could be next year, it could be the year after that, also we don't even know what we're supposed to be voting on, because David Cameron says that he's renegotiating to change our relationship with the EU, but we don't know if he's going to achieve those changes. In fact, we don't even know what those changes are going to be. So I don't really know why we're talking about it. I think we should all have an agreement never to mention it for, you know, at least another 18 months, or until we know some kind of information about it, or even better, let's not even bother with renegotiations. I don't care what the result is. I don't care if we're in or we're out, just as long as, once we've got a result, we never speak of it again. It's not even begun and I've already had enough.
You know? I'd even be interested when China's membership of the EU comes up. But it is the stealth of tedium that grinds people down. It is that the way that lawyers draft these things. That's why so many politicians are lawyers, because you just lose the will to live.
It won't finish, though, will it? I mean, you think you got to the end of an EU story and then there's more. It's a sort of Russian doll of boredom.
Yeah.
But why is he even talking about it?
Because it's in the news and we have to. It's our remit. It's in the BBC charter.
Not him, Jeremy. Not him.
Oh, him.
I wasn't thinking he was doing warm-up for the news quiz.
Because he's Canadian, and if you're Canadian, let's face it, there's not much to talk about. So what you do, you think, well, I'll intervene in other people's foreign affairs and run their central banks for them, because there's only so much maple syrup you can smear on a moose. That's what they do, the Mounties, that's what they do.
That really ought to be the end of all debate on the matter. I mean, what do you think, Yasmin? Do you think it's, you know, good, bad, harmless bit of fun?
I'm watching an awful lot of The Wire recently, so I haven't really had a chance to read any newspapers. So,
Which season of The Wire are you on?
I'm only on season one. I'm on episode three, and I don't understand what anyone's saying. But I'm going to stick with it.
But it's very
That's exactly how I feel about Europe.
Poundingly, Bank of England Governor Mark Carney gave a landmark speech this week regarding the financial impact of Britain's inclusion in the EU. Carney managed to add fuel to the fire of both the in and out campaigns, essentially wading into the never-ending debate on Europe like a man trying to stop a punch-up in the street by simultaneously shouting, "He's not worth it," and "I'll hold your coat." George Osborne claimed the speech set out the principles for renegotiation before returning to the more important task of giving President Xi a relaxing back rub with extras. In this instance, all of Britain's infrastructure at a knockdown price. Arch Eurosceptic and retired vampire Lord Nigel Lawson hit out at Carney, saying he shouldn't have waded into the debate. Well, yes, he's only the governor of the Bank of England, isn't he? What does he know about money? Much better to ask someone who's now only really known for fathering a lady who has somehow managed to over-sexualise Trey Bakes. 2 points to Michael. Yasmin, who doesn't believe life should be sweet?
Public Health England have brought out a report that suggests that there should be a sugar tax on fizzy drinks and the like to kind of combat the whole obesity epidemic. And I have to say, at the beginning of the year, for 6 months, I went for 6 months with no sugar whatsoever. And it was so dull. So I'm not exactly sold on it, having lived through it. Some would call me a soldier.
But it's a drug. It is, I mean, because it stimulates dopamine in the brain and it is really, really addictive. But there is that terrible sugar come down as well, that awful sort of crashing despair that you get 4 or 5 minutes after a Malteser. You just... life just seems bleak and pointless, and then you're on your way to your next Malteser, which is really a gateway chocolate.
Don't you think that a sugar tax would be actually quite irresponsible, because the idea of having sugar tax is to reduce obesity? But actually, it's the opposite we need, because the biggest problem we face in this country is an ageing population. You know, economically, it costs so much. So what we need is not for people to get healthier, but for people to get unhealthier, you know, so that we can really bring that life expectancy down, to, you know, cut the cost of pensions, NHS and stuff like that. So instead of a sugar tax, we need a salad tax. We need a kebab shop in every classroom. We need tax breaks for people who produce fizzy drinks and chocolate bars and meths.
I love the idea that from now on, Werther's original adverts are just a child force-feeding their grandparents.
Why did Jamie Oliver have to get involved, if I may ask a question we've all asked ourselves on countless different occasions?
I think I admire him. He is trying to make us all better. He's really fighting for us, but we don't care. That's the thing. It's like going, stop it, we're fine.
He pretended to be Italian. He's got these things up everywhere saying, Jamie's Italian. Really, really not. He's from Essex.
Jamie Oliver's idea for this is that all fizzy drinks should have a little label on them saying how many teaspoons of sugar, like, so a can of Coke's got 9 teaspoons of sugar and a Dr. Pepper's got 6. And he thinks that by putting that on, that will discourage people from buying them. But I kind of think it might be the other way around, because, I mean, when I'm buying a bottle of wine, I don't know anything about wine, but I just look at the alcohol content. If it says 11% alcohol, I think, oh, but this one's 13.5%. So you would think, if you're looking at a can of Dr. Pepper and a can of Coke and you're thinking, well, this one's got 9 teaspoons of sugar. Well, that's value for money. I'm getting more there. I'm going to buy my Coke.
But in all seriousness, there's an argument. In the same way that you can't sell alcohol to anyone under the age of 18, if they really, really cared about giving kids too much sugar, they should just make those drinks illegal to children. If you really care about it, I don't think adding 7p to a can of Coke... I mean, you can buy a litre of lemonade in most supermarkets for about 20p. So 27p, it's not exactly breaking the bank. I can't understand how that small amount is really going to put people off.
You don't think that children are put off by taxation?
You know, kids aren't stupid. It's like when I was a kid, we were always told we had to clean our teeth. You've got to clean your teeth, make sure your teeth are amazing. And then you found out that if your teeth fell out, you got money from the tooth fairy. And you were like, well, then if I don't clean my teeth, I could really clean up on these. It doesn't make any sense.
You're monetizing your teeth. And that's entrepreneurial, and that's what we need to see more of in this country. So we need to see children with fewer teeth.
Listen to this. My friend gave her kid £10 the other day for a tooth that had fallen out. What? £10. When I was a kid in 1986...
Had she punched her? Or something?
When I was a kid in 1986, I got 20p for my tooth. It just makes me think, I should have just invested in children's teeth back in the 80s.
I got nothing. My mother just said, that's what happens. They fall out. That was it.
So there was no such thing as a tooth fairy in Ireland?
Well, there was. She just wouldn't pay for it.
The first lot are supposed to fall out, though, aren't they? Because then you get the new lot.
Yeah.
It's when the second lot fall out that you're in trouble. And you start waiting. All those people on the Jeremy Kyle show waiting for their third teeth to come in. Can't be long now.
Cloyingly, these are the recommendations of Public Health England, that a tax on sugary foods and drinks could help to cut childhood obesity. Because nothing helps to calm a child screaming at you for Cocoa Pops more than the words, you may think you want them, Bryony, but you're only helping to swell the coffers of Her Majesty's Treasury. You simply must learn to love porridge. Dr. Alison Tedston of Public Health England told MPs that she was worried about bottomless cups in restaurants. And we should worry. That is a basic design flaw. For God's sake, will nobody think of the trousers? Jamie Oliver has supported the introduction of the sugar tax, feeling it will discourage consumption in much the same way you'd think charging £13 for linguine would put right-minded people off eating in one of his restaurants. The problem is, if you give people control over their lives, they probably won't make the healthiest of choices because fundamentally healthy choices are rubbish. Eating quinoa and then going running, for example, is rather less enjoyable than eating custard while sitting still. Two points to Yasmin. And at the end of round one, the scores are Yasmin and Michael have 4, but Jeremy and Holly have 5. We start round two with a cabin announcement from Norwegian Airlines.
As we start our descent into London Gatwick, we would like to remind passengers that the toilets are now closed and the cabin crew will be collecting any waste.
Thanks to Gareth Hodge for sending us that.
This is true. I once flew on Manx Airlines. Nice plane, no tail. But I went to use the loo, and sitting on the actual lavatory pan was the box of snacks for the flight. And I went up to one of the stewardesses and I said, "Excuse me, I wanted to use the loo, but our snacks are on it." And she went, "Shh."
Jeremy, which hardliner wants to clamp down on extremists?
Oh, the lovely Theresa May, who wants to be leader of the Tory party but can't be because she is so forlorn that the idea of her as prime minister, it would like being be governed by Eeyore, wouldn't it? It would just... But in addition to, you know, occasionally parroting bite about immigrants, she is concerned about extremism. The trouble is extremism is in some ways in the eyes of the beholder. If somebody is not saying something illegal, incitement to violence can be criminalised. People can be prosecuted for incitement to things. But if somebody is just sharing their ideas, how do you deal with that? And she wants to sort of police more strongly people saying things that aren't illegal that are just what they think, which is a slippery slope. Because, you know, all sorts of weird myths and lies and distortions are in circulation, whether it's people saying that the Pentagon was not hit by a plane on 9/11 or people saying that Labour were responsible for the banking crash. All these things are out there and you can't really do much about it. And the trouble is teenagers are prey to this stuff because it's easy to indoctrinate vulnerable and impressionable young people and get them involved in wars they don't understand. That's why army recruitment starts at 16. But she's basically trying to sort of shut people up who are saying stuff that they think, and you can't really do that.
They use this weird phrase a lot, entryist. Have you heard this?
Yeah.
They keep going on about the drive against entryist and extremists, and I think that word entry... Like, what is an entry-level extremist? Is that just an extremist who's just there to do data entry? Or, like, as an extremist on a zero-hour contract? Or, like... a community support extremist who's not actually allowed a bomb but can show you places to put them. Like, what does that mean?
I think it's maybe a kind of a work shadowing thing where you follow around someone who's got a bomb strapped to them and just to see what they do. And then they get blown up. And
things we shouldn't worry so much about terrorism. The reason why it's a very unpopular career is because, really, there is not much future in it, especially since the suicide element was brought in. Since the bombing was outsourced to Dignitas, let's be honest, the... It's terrorism is a career with very little progression, isn't it? And ultimately, I think we just got to accept that occasionally these things are going to happen and just get on with life. You know, if people are going to decide that they want to, you know, strap a bomb to themselves and blow something up, then there's not much you can do about it. If somebody wants to go mad in Topps tiles with an axe, they will, and it will be a blessed release to customers and staff. But,
do you get asked to do a lot of sort of morale-boosting chats? Security services. I mean, we've got all this technology and stuff, we're meant to be tracking them, but in the end of the day, what can you really do?
Well, do you know what? They have all these machines and things so they can find bombs, and they've got that question that they ask you, like, did you pack your bag yourself? As though you're going to say, Well, no, I normally do, but the leader of our cell, he put up, oh, no! You caught me out. And the thing is, you go up to this machine, and the thing is, if you had a bomb on you, you'd blow it up then, wouldn't you? You'd think, well, I'm either going to say, oh, that's torn it, the whole mission's off, I'll have to go home and defuse this now. Rather than that, you'd set it off, and you'd destroy all the expensive new airport equipment and some really nosy buggers.
Joe, as part of this, originally, Theresa May wanted all TV programmes to be vetted in advance for extremist content. And I thought, that's a bit weird, because I don't think I've ever seen a programme on British TV that has extremist content. I mean, I don't think I've ever seen an episode of EastEnders where someone says, oh, I wouldn't go down the Queen Vic tonight, Ian. I'm flying a plane into it later.
Things I find unnerving about it is that it's basically they're talking about Islam. They keep saying, oh, it's extremist, but they really are specifically talking about one thing when they're talking about it. I mean, like, I have really extreme views on men that wear thumb rings. I think it's disgusting. I don't understand why people do that, but it's not illegal to have an extreme view. It's illegal to do something about it or to incite other people to do it. I find that really uncomfortable.
And how is this going to affect the already incredibly high morale in our public services?
Well, my sister's a primary school teacher, and I am going to use this next couple of days to really cycle out about this, because my dad was Pakistani, so we have a Muslim name, and she's got an Irish accent. I mean, in terms of, like, we're, like, I'm going to send so many emails, but, like, just check up on her, because you don't know who sent her. She could be from anywhere. And just really... and really get her into loads of trouble. So that's how I'm going to make a change today.
So there's the idea then that you would snoop on other people at work, I suppose, as you watch out for, you know, any signs of extremism, whatever, if someone's having, I don't know...
Isn't that what HR is for? Like, surely if there's one point of an HR department, it's to keep an eye on people who are terrorists. That was probably more important than the person who steals reams of paper to take home and use at their printer
Dear
at home.
Dear Jenny, I noticed you've had 3 days off sick this month. Are you sure you were sick, or were you making a dirty bomb?
And if you do commit a terrorist atrocity, you will get a written warning.
Tellingly, Home Secretary to me... Oh, God.
That's one of the easy ones, Theresa.
What are you witnessing? Tellingly, Home Secretary Theresa May has commissioned a report to find out if schools, charities and the civil service may be infiltrated by Islamists and other extremists, although it's possible that to the Conservatives the definition of other extremists is anyone who works in the public sector. The review will engage charities and businesses to help them identify entryist behaviour by means of a multiple-choice test. Are you an extremist? Yes or no? Or why do you want to work here? A, because I want to destroy British society, or B, because I'm passionate about IT consultancy. There are worries that the review will lead to McCarthyism, which I believe is the practice of behaving exactly like the journalist and former Beirut hostage John McCarthy. Basically means going around rooting out extremists in the public sector while occasionally making light-hearted Radio 4 travel documentaries. The review also states that broadcasters will not be allowed to give extremists a platform to preach harm or... Oh, God. I mean, what, you know...
Tell you what, Miles, what you should do is, when the audience aren't here, just say all the words that there are in the language into the tape machine, and they can just edit you together.
I'd be worried if I did that. They'd then randomise them, and it would make me sound like I was talking shit. Do you know what I mean? Rather than the very carefully nuanced screen I'm attempting. The review also states that broadcasters will not be allowed to give extremists a platform to preach harmful messages and falsehoods without critical challenge. In other words, you can put Rod Little on Question Time, but then Dimbleby has to mutter the words irredeemable arse every time he speaks. 2 points to Jeremy. Holly, who needs to be kept in line online?
Oh, this is Amazon. They're taking legal action against fake reviewers, specifically people who get paid to write reviews, because they found these companies that would write reviews for your products and give you 5 stars, and it sort of bumps up. I mean, the whole reviewing, the star system in reviewing doesn't really work, because, you know, my idea of a 4-star could be your idea of a 2-star.
Easily.
Yeah. Makes sense, because I really sort of worry that if they start shutting down fake reviewers, then they're going to start shutting down the brilliant reviewers, the people who genuinely use Amazon as one of the best comedy platforms. But there is, there was an example in the paper this week. It was a novelty horse Halloween mask, and somebody had written, given it 5 stars, but then in the caption said, false representation. And they had written, the good news, my horse head arrived, fits nicely and looks great. The bad news, after great debate, my wife insists I am not qualified to wear it naked. Later on in these reviews, somebody else had written, it is day 87 and the horses have accepted me as one of their own. On Amazon of this Paul Ross printed canvas. For some reason, that's become the one that everybody writes joke reviews on. Someone wrote 1 star, don't buy this picture. It looks fine on the website, but the one that they sent me was upside down. My wife hasn't stopped crying for a week. I mean...
Community-mindedly, reading out loud is hard, I've discovered tonight. So if I get this one right, I'm taking the lot off.
Now, the audience addressing you with their eyes.
I feel I've backed myself into a corner here, but I'll... No, I'll go for it. Community-mindedly, Amazon has launched legal proceedings in the United States against over 1,000 fake reviewers, offering their services for as little as $5 a go to write fictitious reviews for products and services. Alarms were first raised when a customer reviewed Amazon's financial practices and found them to be completely above board. I've never put a review on Amazon, simply because I'm not labouring under the delusion that my opinions have any weight or merit, which is why I keep them just to myself and a depressed audience of millions. What distresses me is that all this legal activity is going to distract Amazon from their core activity of driving independent booksellers out of business and generally contributing to the ongoing degradation of all human... Oh.
Sorry, they're staying on, guys. They're staying on.
The nerves got to me. And generally contributing to the ongoing degradation of all humanity. Amazon has served writs against the 1,000 people, although if they were out, a writ was served on their neighbours. Two points to Holly. Michael, have a listen to this.
Coming from the hand, studying the hand, entering the world of the hat, reaching through the world of the hat like a wind.
Michael, who said hats off to bad manners?
I think this is Country Life magazine. They've got an article saying that men need to start wearing hats again because it will make them behave better. The article says, raised for a lady, removed in church or for a national anthem, hats facilitate the expression of courtesy and respect. They lend dignity and, ipso facto, dignified behaviour. Which sounds nice. I don't really know if it's true, though, because I think quite a lot of bad people in history have worn hats without necessarily being very well behaved. I mean, Mussolini wore hats, Napoleon... Dick Dastardly, you know. I mean, Stalin used to wear a hat, and I don't suppose, you know, he would wake up in the morning bareheaded in bed and think, I think I might starve and or execute 20 million people today. And then he'd put his hat on and he'd think, oh, I think that would be frightfully uncouth. I shall desist. So I'm not really convinced about this.
I have a massive problem with indoor hats. You know, the way when you go to a party and somebody is wearing a hat... inside, and they've taken their coat off and they're there for about half an hour, and you're going, they're wearing that hat for the rest of the night, aren't they? They're not going to... And when you talk to them, you realise they don't have a personality, they just have a hat.
And at weddings, they call them fascinators, don't they?
And
it's just a sort of fishing fly on a bit of coat hanger. I am a bit suspicious of hats, really, because they're not strictly necessary. Do you know what I mean? You think somebody's put that on and looked in the mirror and thought, yeah, I'm wearing a hat. And they look like a sort of failed art critic.
Yeah. Well, that's what they're worried about. They're worried that the reason why hats have become unpopular is because they've become too ironic, that there are too many hipsters wearing baseball hats and, you know, ironic fedoras and all that kind of stuff, and that they've really ruined it for everyone else. I mean, I just want to see them bring back those Scottish hats with the ginger bits.
Well, bucolically, this is the claim made by Country Life magazine that British politeness has declined since we all stopped wearing hats. We have to be careful to distinguish this report was by Country Life the magazine and not Country Life the butter. What Country Life the butter's view is on this subject has yet to be ascertained, but we wait with bated breath. Hats are useful when it comes to politeness. It's terrible when you don't have a hat to take off and find yourself removing your trousers in a misguided attempt to show respect to a lady. It is, of course, very important to remember that hats alone are not enough, and some other form of clothing is still as good as mandatory. Before we reveal the final scores, has anybody got a cutting they'd like to share? Jeremy?
Miles, this was sent in by Lisa Donnellan, and it's a flyer from the Old Shop Cafe. Sizzling sausage and mash night. Watch our resident butcher build a banger and have a go yourself, followed by a sausage and mash supper with coffee and brownies, plus a little bit of after-supper sausage entertainment.
Holly.
This is a promotional offer from an estate agent, which was launched to coincide with the Rugby World Cup. It says, win a 55-inch Panasonic TV and balls to all our customers.
Yasmin.
I saw the word Ireland and lost it. That's what drew me to this ad. It was from an eBay seller called John Kelly. It's another Rugby World Cup. It's an Irish World Cup beanie hat. And then a little note that says, seller does not deliver to Ireland. So that's going to...
Michael.
This was spotted by Julia Shirley of County Antrim, Northern Ireland, and it's from the Daily Mail website. Story reads, award-winning comedian Dawn French has publicly shared that she enjoys her intimate moments in full physical display. Speaking to the Times magazine, the 58-year-old star defiantly revealed that she has never had sex with the light off. Scroll down for video.
Thank you. And now let's take a look at the final score, which shows that Jeremy and Holly have 11 and Yasmin and Michael have 8. Before we leave you, here is a cutting from a poster seen in Winchester, sent in by Martin Cook.
Some of the River Itchen's otters emerge from the river at night to mark their territory with pungent droppings. The otters are filmed by motion-sensitive cameras.
And with that, goodbye!
Taking part in the news quiz were Jeremy Hardy, Holly Walsh, Yasmin Akram and Michael Deacon. In the chair was Miles Jupp, and the news was read by me, Zeb Soames. The chair script was written by Gabby Hutchinson-Crouch, James Kettle and Simon Littlefield, with additional material by Liam Byrne and Josh Clubery. The producer was Richard Morris, and it was a BBC Radio comedy production.